Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
There's an old saying, and you've probably heard it from your parents, teachers, or coaches, that winners never quit and quitters never win. But does this adage apply to the Catholic papacy? In the entire history of the papacy, numbering, as of today, 265 popes, from Peter to Benedict XVI, there has been only one Holy Father who has resigned the post willingly. And that person was Peter Maroni, better known as Celestine V, who occupied St. Peter's chair for a little more than 5 months in the year 1294. Despite this remarkable short reign, short even by standards of papal tenures, Peter Maroni was canonized only a few decades after his death and became Saint Celestine. No pope has subsequently taken the name Celestine. Given his short range, what is so significant about this man that would possess somebody to pen an entire biography about him some 8 centuries after his death? The author of that biography, John Sweeney, joins us today to answer that question and reveal some rather interesting details about one of the more enigmatic popes that have ever held that position. Mr. Sweeney is an independent scholar, editor-in-chief at Paraclete Press, a popular speaker, and the author of numerous books, including Verily, Verily, the King James Version, 400 Years of Influence and Beauty, the St. Francis Prayer Book, Beauty Awakening Belief, How the Medieval Worldview Inspires Faith Today, and Born Again and Again, Surprising Gifts of a Fundamentalist Childhood. Most recently, he has written The Pope Who Quit, a true medieval tale of mystery, death, and salvation, which is the focus of our discussion today. As usual, we will link to these books and others on our website, so please pay us a visit and also connect with us on Facebook so that you can get updates on forthcoming guests. And now that we are at 100 episodes, you might also want to sift through our archived interviews to find some more interesting topics that might appeal to you. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony.
Hey, I want to start out by complimenting you on an extremely well-written book. For a biography of a very obscure pope, it actually is a page-turner that not only tells us about the life of this guy, Peter Maroni, but also provides us with some rather interesting tidbits about the papacy in general, as well as history about the church, and not just the church in the 13th century, but you extend it to other periods of time as well. Now, of the 100 interviews that I've conducted now, I can honestly say this is one of the most enjoyable and refreshing books that I've read, and would highly recommend that all our listeners pick up a copy of it. And I wish a lot more academic books were written this lively.
Well, I appreciate that. And in your introduction, I noticed, of course, that you called it a biography. I didn't actually set out to write a biography so much. I mean, I set out to write a popular history. So, I mean, I'm delighted to hear that you enjoyed reading the book, because that's what I wanted to create, was a narrative history of this time period focusing on this person in a way that would engage a reader in a lot of the issues that you mentioned in your introduction, all those issues that draws us to the late medieval period and some of the strangeness and the mysteries, and in the case of this story, you know, a little bit of murder and a little bit of conniving, and those things that are in part of the medieval history of the papacy and of the church, you know, the good and the bad, it all comes together. So, I mean, I was trying to tell kind of a big story while focusing in on a particular unusual, genuinely unique character in the history of the church.
Well, you accomplished that very well, and I think one of the things that a good biography does is not only just tell us about a person, which, you know, most people have that in their mind. A biography is going to tell me the day-to-day life of a person. But it tells us about the life and times of a person. It tells us about many people around that person and the culture in general. And that you definitely accomplish that in this book.
Yeah, and I guess the only reason I don't usually claim the name biography for this book is because there are a couple places in the book where I say things like, now, for the next two decades, we know almost nothing about what he did.
Yeah.
You know, so it's tough to tell that kind of a story about almost any late medieval figure. I mean, there are still scholars today who debate whether or not Geoffrey Chaucer even existed, and scholars generally will never agree as to when he was born or when he died. Same thing, of course, with William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So when you look at a figure like Peter Morone or Celestine V, of whom we know infinitely, or at least we think we know infinitely less than those sorts of famous late medieval figures or Renaissance figures, you can see that it's, you know, it can be difficult to write a biography by the standards that people might have in their minds when they think of, you know, the great new biography of Teddy Roosevelt,
mm-hmm.
or Thomas Jefferson, or something like that.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's a point in time that Peter Morone basically disappears from the radar screen, and you have that, you know, several decade gap of we don't know anything about this guy. That in itself, though, is a very telling part of the biography. So I wouldn't sell yourself short. I mean, this is a biography. It's a history of the 13th century and beyond. It's a great book.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, speaking about biographies, and before we get into the life of Celestine V here, I have to ask you a little autobiographical question, because if my listeners were listening closely in the introduction, one of the titles of one of your other books that I mentioned was called Born Again and Again, Surprising Gifts of a Fundamentalist Childhood. And I was coming up with your biography to introduce you for the show. Wow, that title just stuck with me. And I haven't read it yet. I just saw the book title and the picture of the cover on your website. Now, you seem to have devoted most of your academic energy to exploring the medieval church, the Catholic Church. So that kind of gave me the impression of a Catholic. What's this fundamentalism business all about?
Well, I'll tell you briefly. I mean, I think my own sort of spiritual journey in many ways mirrors the things that I've written about over the last, I've been writing books for about 12 years. And, I've written a couple of books that are in the memoir category, and then some books that are history, and then some spirituality. So, but in all of my work, there is an aspect of, you know, I devoted a year or 2 years or whatever to writing a certain book because it's an issue that I'm passionately interested in. And so in that sense, I'm not like a typical academic author, I suppose, in that I'm often writing about something that I have some personal investment in my own spiritual journey. So anyway, to answer your question, I grew up in an evangelical, mostly fundamentalist evangelical environment. I grew up in Wheaton, Illinois, you know, the mecca of evangelicalism.
Yep, that's, what's the college there?
Oh, did you? Well, so did I.
Yeah.
So,
oh, no, I didn't attend college there. I was going to say, Wheaton College.
Yeah, I went to Wheaton College.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went to Wheaton Academy, which is sort of the prep school for Wheaton College, and I also went to Wheaton College. But before I actually got to Wheaton College, I went to Moody Bible Institute for a year, and then the summer after that year, for about 4 months, I was a missionary in the Philippines. I was a assistant church planter who was sent over by the Conservative Baptist Foreign Missionary Society to assist missionaries who were already working in one of the provinces. I was supposed to start and recruit and invigorate a youth group over the course of my time there. But I mean, our general purpose was, I mean, if you're a missionary to a country like the Philippines, which is about, I don't know, 8% Muslim and, you know, 91% Roman Catholic and 1% other, it's not hard to figure out that I was sent there to convert Catholics and make them into Baptists, rebaptize them and create an evangelical church in the midst of a very Roman Catholic country and province where I was. And so it was that summer, when I turned 19, that I realized something was wrong, clearly, with the way in which I had been brought up spiritually and religiously, because I actually sort of fell in love with Catholicism. I mean, I fell in love with the sights and the sounds and the ideas and the saints and the practices and the prayer and the beauty of Catholicism. So as I would be in someone's living room leading a Bible study using my Matthew Henry commentary, I would be kind of looking over to the side at the images that they might have had on their in their home altar, or I would have observed the way in which the mother or the father, what the religious practices were as I was talking with the son and the daughter about, you know, the evangelical practices that I was there to promote and that sort of thing. And I kind of fell in love with Catholicism. So all of that is to say I was a lousy, lousy missionary. And then part of my journey then became the kind of stuff that I then wrote a lot about over the last 15 years, which means I wrote a lot about Catholic history and practice from the perspective of a Protestant who is increasingly drawn to those things. So that's what some of those books that you mentioned have been about. And then, but then part of my journey was that then sort of finally, I became a Catholic myself a few years ago and was received into the church. But even then, I don't feel like that's the end of my story, because my story is ongoing, and I continue to write and experience other things. And my religious life continues to be more complicated than just simply one thing. So my blog has always been called Almost Catholic because I started it before I was received into the church, and I've continued to have my blog called Almost Catholic because I don't feel like that necessarily defines me either. I'm answering your question in a very long way. Let me just say the last thing is whenever I'm talking to an audience and I introduce myself, kind of like what you just wanted me to talk about myself before we get going on the Pope Who Quit, I say some of these kind of things that I've been saying to you, and then I usually say something like, religious identities, spiritual identities are really complicated, don't you think? I mean, it's not really that easy, at least not for me, to define my religious or spiritual identity in kind of a neat and tidy package. And whenever I say something like that, I always find like half of the people in the audience shaking their head vigorously, like, yes, I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah. No, no, I understand. Interestingly, you're our second guest that I know of, at least, who has been an evangelical, then converted to Catholicism. The other one was Jim Papandrea, who, interestingly enough, is very interested in the early life of the Catholic Church, early church fathers he's done, and we'll link to his site. So, and it, nothing against Baptists, right? Because we are sponsored by Baylor.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, nothing. Okay. Nothing against Baptists. All right. I love the tradition from which I came. In fact, I should say that that book that you mentioned, that memoir, Born Again and Again, the subtitle is very deliberate and was very deliberate. The Surprising Gifts of a Fundamentalist Childhood. It is not one of these sort of crash and burn books about how I've turned away from everything that I learned as a child. Completely on the contrary, it's a book in which I wanted in every chapter to describe something very specific about my evangelical, sometimes fundamentalist background in childhood, and then pull something out that I treasure today, that I learn from, that I retain, that I love, even though I might not find myself there anymore. So, it's been a process for me of not burning any bridges at all, but sort of following the journey, following the stones along the way.
Well, as we record this on April 3rd of 2012, tonight the Women's National Basketball Championship is between Notre Dame and Baylor. So I'm wondering if you have any mixed feelings about that or something. I don't know. Anyways, we're going to have to get you back onto the show after we conduct this interview and talk about that some more, because it's a fascinating topic that I could go on for hours and hours about. But let's go ahead and dig into the life of this guy, Peter Moroni, also known as Celestine the Fifth. He lived a pretty long life, roughly 84 years or so, which is quite extraordinary for someone in the medieval era. And his life it spanned the bulk of the 13th century. So again, this is really not only a biography, but it's a tale of the 13th century and the surrounding centuries as well. So give us an idea of what life was like back then in the 13th century. More specifically, what was the Christian church like in that century?
Well, of course, in the West, which is what my story is about, as opposed to the East, I mean, it was an exclusively Catholic environment. I mean, there was only one church. This was even before the time for the most part, before the time in England where you would have had the emergence of the Lollards and, you know, the movements that became what we then eventually knew enough to call pre-Reformation. But in the West, particularly in Peter's Italy, there was only one church, and this was it. And then in the East, there was Orthodoxy because the Great Schism had happened in 1054. And so it was a split between East and West. But the church in the West was, in the 13th century, had a lot of terrific characters, and it had a lot of awful ones. And that was the case for many centuries before that, too. I mean, what we traditionally call the Dark Ages was done. And this was a period of sort of pre-Renaissance of learning and the emergence of a middle class, the emergence of new understandings and bigger perspective of people on the world. Travel had increased in ways that brought merchants from other places. So there was a sense of the world was getting larger for the average villager in Peter Morone's part of Italy. But at the same time, there was this situation in the church where the church was dominated by power. I mean, it was dominated by men. Of course, it was exclusively men. Men who were seeking power and sometimes using religion for that power, sometimes using sort of brute force or political power, but very often using those things all together.
Now, one of the other things that's interesting about this era is you see an uptick in monastic life. Now, you know, monastic life has been with the church almost dating back to the very first century of Christianity, but you start to see, you know, figures like St. Francis at this time. He leads to the Franciscans and the Benedictines too. So what was monastic life like, and why was it a big deal back then?
Well, and let me answer that. And in my answer, let me help give your listener a point that they can connect Peter Morone, who we're talking about, with something broader that they, I'm sure they have a background and have read about, which is St. Francis of Assisi. So St. Francis is a beginning of the Franciscan movement. I mean, the year that is usually the marking of the beginning of the Franciscan movement, which means that Francis had his first followers. He wasn't just doing his sort of radical discipleship conversion on his own, but he had a few friends who were with him, was in 1209. 1209 was that year, and that it was also that year that Francis wrote his first version of the rule, his rule for life, and then he and his group of sort of ragtag friends walked to Rome to try and get the Pope's blessing on their movement. That was all in 1209. Well, that's the same year in which Peter Morone was born. So that gives you a little bit of a framework. And in terms of what monasticism was like, let me go back to Francis to answer that, which is the Franciscan movement. What was radical about the Franciscan movement and the Dominicans, which were founded right at the same time, Francis and Dominic were exact contemporaries, was that they created what we now know as a friar. Monasticism up until that point was cloistered. It was men living increasingly in large monasteries that were very well protected and very well funded and very powerful, increasingly very powerful. If you were lucky enough to get your son accepted into one of them, you knew that your son would probably never want. So it was a poor mother's dream to have their son accepted into one of the large monasteries in, say, the year 1200. So what Francis was doing by creating the Franciscan movement, which of course he didn't call it that, and that he wasn't planning on creating a big movement, but it became an enormous movement, was he created the friar. He created the man who lived by monastic principles, but who didn't live cloistered, who lived out among the people for the most part, who worked in the fields often with the folks, who preached in the city squares, who begged for his bread, who lived a very different kind of a life than that life of power and security that monasteries had become by the year 1200.
So those are the monastic folks, right? They're you know, kind of live in the early Christian life of, you know, foregoing a lot of the church power and the wealth and privilege that comes along with this. Tell us a little bit about what I would call the high church. Now, all those folks that become elite members of the clergy, maybe become cardinals or who become pope, who are these folks at that time?
Well, they were, I mean, this is a big part of the story I tell in The Pope Who Quit, is that, I mean, it's particularly when you go all the way up the ladder to the cardinals. I mean, they were what is often referred to as, the phrase is, the princes of the church. Much more the princes of the church as opposed to, you know, its most devoted followers of Jesus. There's a pretty big difference by this era between those two categories, sadly. These are men who were combining civil and religious power in their lives, and they were, I mean, if any of your listeners, for instance, have seen the Jeremy Irons Showtime Network Borgia program, they have a little bit of an idea of this. That era is a little bit later than the one that we're talking about, but all of that began, that kind of power and influence in the church itself, in the highest ranks of the church itself, began in this era of Peter Maroni in the 13th century. So the higher that you rose in the church, you really could not rise to those kinds of levels of archbishop or cardinal or Vatican insider of any kind unless you were someone who was seeking power that was much further and broader than what we would think of as of spiritual power only. The idea that the Pope, for instance, would be a spiritual leader primarily or only, completely foreign to this era that we're talking about.
And much like the princes and kings of the era, the dynamics that go on in trying to get power, you tend to get families that dominate who's going to be who in here. And this is essentially what you have in Italy during this time, right?
Definitely. I mean, there were two families that dominated the religious life in these days and who dominated the College of Cardinals who would choose a pope, too. I mean, it was the Orsinis and the Colonnas. And these two families would dominate the church for decades, even centuries. So in the election of 1292 to 1294...
The one preceding Maroni, right?
Yeah, is when Peter Maroni was elected pope. It was clear from the beginning that, which is why it went on for so long, this particular election went on for so long, because it was clear that it would be a very protracted process. There had to be a two-thirds majority for any successful election, and it was going to be almost impossible for this to happen because these two most powerful families, the Orsinis and the Colonnas, would prevent a new pope from being crowned by deadlock after deadlock as each of them is trying to get their man in.
Mm-hmm. And this is what makes the book read so well, is that you see the clash of these two different cultures, the very high church, the princes of the church, as you call them, of the wealth and power, the, you know, gold-encrusted tiaras that are bestowed upon the Pope, and then these Franciscan guys living humbly, begging for bread. And Maroni actually is the intersection of this stuff by the end of the 13th century. Now, you start off your book with the election of Peter Maroni. That's one of the first chapters that we come across here. And that whole episode is, I found, rather humorous, just because of the families debating over this kind of thing and how this all comes about. But I'm going to step us back before we get to that and take us back to Maroni's life in general. So let's kind of talk about his upbringing. You said he was born in 1209. What was his early life like, his first couple decades on planet Earth?
Well, and let me just preface, these are some of the things that we don't know a whole lot about. Peter wrote an autobiography, some pages of memoir, at some point in his life before the age of 30. And we have this text, and we think we can trust it for the most part. The text has some of these marks of later editors' hands, as often happens in sort of a hagiographical tradition to make things a little bit more rosy than perhaps they were. But on the other hand, there are some things in this text that are revealing and sort of embarrassing to the subject of Peter Maroni. So you would think a later editor wouldn't have added such things in order to make him sound better than he was. And so we think we can trust this, too. So in this text he tells about his family. I mean, he tells a little bit about his mother and father. He tells about his father dying when he's rather young. He talks about his brothers. He talks about how his older brothers never understood the religious leanings and spiritual desires of him, and he was quite lonely, and his mother protected him from his older brothers. So we get that kind of a picture in terms of family life. And he grew up in one of the most remote regions of Italy, in a very small village, in a family completely without power or influence. You know, this was an era when people would work, you know, finger to the bone in order to make ends meet, and his family was no different, particularly when the father died. It would have been very difficult, and the mother would have been faced with decisions about what to do with the sons, and could some of the sons help care for her? And then by the time Peter reaches the age of 12 or 13, she's faced with this son whom she seems to have adored, this younger son who she seems to have adored and who has these spiritual desires, and she is delighted to be able to send him off to a monastery.
So he gets sent off to a monastery. But actually, I have an aside, because you mentioned he grew up in this remote area of Italy, and you're one of my Facebook friends, and so this is how I stumbled across your book. And I noticed that you have some pictures on your Facebook page that it looks like you're in Italy. Did you ever get a chance to visit the village that Moroni grew up in?
No, I didn't get to go to the very village. I did. I've been to Italy several times, in part occasionally because of my work on Francis and Claire of Assisi. So I've spent a lot of time in Assisi. But in my early research for this book, I traveled with a friend to Rome and to Naples. Naples, as we'll probably get to in a little while as we talk about this story, is where Peter Morone cum Celestine V papacy took place. It didn't take place in Rome, and that's one of the odd things about his story. So I spent time seeing all of the places I needed to see that were relevant to the story in Rome and Naples, but no, I actually did not get to that little village.
It must just be some really interesting facet of doing this kind of historical research, that you're studying all this stuff from afar, but then you get to go there and you just think about the people who walked on that same road that you're walking on. That's a pretty cool feeling, huh?
I do, and I get the same feeling. Absolutely, that's one of the things I love about this sort of work, and I sort of feel those things too. I mean, I hope that readers of my books, and you know, listeners to programs like yours, I guess I hope that they get those feelings as well, and put their imaginations into the time and place as they read. Because I think there is something profound. You know, we live in a time, of course, when travel is so easy, and we don't deal with other things in ways that our ancestors did only 100 years ago. Things like we can turn the lights on at night. You know, I mean, there's no darkness for half of our lives imposed on us because of the lack of technology and some of these other kinds of things. But when you start to consider some of these ways in which our lives are so dramatically different today than they were, say, 800 years ago when Peter Morone was living, it kind of helps to put yourself into their situation and walk those streets and get a feel for those lives, because their spirit, their emotions, the things they struggled with are exactly the things that we struggle with today. It's just that they did it in such a different environment. I mean, so we have to sort of get the color and the feel of that, I think, and hopefully we accomplish that sometimes in books and films and that sort of thing.
Well, let's plop ourselves into Peter Moroni's shoes and put him into the monastery where we just left off a few minutes ago. A monastery is a place where you could do a lot of spiritual learning. Was Peter Moroni literate? Did he come from a poor background, a middle-class background, a rich background, that he would have the opportunity to learn how to read and write?
He came from a pretty poor background, and the evidence seems to be that he was not particularly literate in the language of the church. He wasn't particularly literate in the ecclesiastical Latin of the church and of most affairs, literate affairs of that day. He went to the monastery as a teenager, and so he certainly would have been exposed to learning, and there's no reason to think that he didn't do a fair amount of it. But There's no evidence in Peter's life that he became a learned man in the sense that, you know, other popes of the medieval era and other important figures of the medieval era we turn to because, you know, Leo the Great, for instance, or Gregory the Great, or even Innocent the Third, the pope who was there in 1209, the year that Francis walked to Rome and the year that Peter Maroney was born, were great orators and writers of commentaries on books of the Bible, and we have collections of some of their sermons. We have none of that of Peter. So he does not seem to have been that kind of a thinker or a scholar. He had a lot of good qualities, but he doesn't seem to have had those qualities.
Well, tell us a little bit about those qualities. He goes into the monastery, and this leads him to a life of a hermit. So what happens in his early 20s, 30s, 40s?
Well, what we know is that he went to the monastery, and this would have been one of the cloistered monasteries. This would have been a Benedictine monastery not far from his home. And we know that he didn't stay very long in that environment. We know what life was like at the monastery, and I've mentioned a little bit of that already. I mean, the allure of religious life was really strong. I mean, not only for spiritual reasons. And the monastery was seen as a place of security and a place of refuge. So Peter experienced that and benefited from that. But for men like Peter, a hermitage actually became a better chance of going on the sort of pilgrimage that he felt called to. And so at the age of 20, probably in about the year 1230, Peter left the monastery and took to the life of a solitary. His autobiography says that he did this on his own initiative, without sanction from any abbot or any bishop, and there's no reason to doubt on that point. And so that's actually an early kind of indicator of Peter's personality. There's a place where Peter tells it in his autobiography. I think he says something like, "There was no servant of God in my region with whom to consult." And so he goes off on his own, pursuing a solitary vocation. But it's an interesting kind of a statement for him to make. I think what it means is there was no one whom I trusted. There was no one who was of the same spirit or mind as I was. I mean, obviously he was in a monastery full of monks. You would think that there would have been, you know, someone with whom he could consult, but he didn't see it that way.
Yeah, he's one of these guys, maybe, I don't know, a little introverted, but just wants to get away from it. And one of the ironies of his life, as I was reading your book, and it's filled with lots of interesting ironies, is that in his effort to get away from everybody, he tends to draw people to him. And I think somewhere in the opening pages of your book, you mentioned that if Peter Maroney was living today, he would be the kind of person that celebrities like the Beatles would seek out as some guru. And, there's a tale that you tell in your book is that he ascends a mountain to get away from folks. And then all of a sudden a bunch of people come to see him and want to be around him. And then he basically goes up higher on the mountain.
Exactly. I think that's something that people like Peter have had to deal with ever since we had, spiritual leaders of any kind. I mean, there have always been those personalities who are drawn to a quieter life, who are drawn to a solitary life, but at the same time have some very sort of profound qualities of wisdom and charisma, and sort of despite themselves, they end up attracting followers and people who want to come and get a word of wisdom from them or who just want to meet them. And all they want to do is just keep going further and further away. And Peter was one of those. Peter was one of those. He wasn't yet, not at this point, I think, where we're talking yet, because when he sets out on this sort of solitary journey leaving the monastery, there's no indication that there was any big following of any kind. It was very much a solitary seeking of what he thought he was called to, but then within a short time he finds it, and then people start following him, to do likewise. And of course, that happened with the first desert fathers and mothers. I mean, it happened with Saint Anthony of Egypt. You know, I mean, I think Thomas Merton jokes about this sort of thing in his journal somewhere, if I remember right, that people would keep taking the train out from Alexandria out to the desert and bothering St. Anthony, you know, to the point where he'd have to tell them to go away, leave me alone. You know, I came out here for a reason. I didn't want to be in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us how this all develops, because he gets his a significant number of followers that, in essence, become their own mendicant order at some point in time. And he becomes, I believe, at some point in his history, lobbies or tries to get to official status as a branch of the Benedictine order. So how does this all occur? How do people even find him? If this guy wants to go away and run away from everybody, back in that era when there aren't that many people, it's very mountainous, you know, areas that he grew up in, remote region. I mean, I figure this guy should just disappear into the wilderness and that's it.
Well, the area to which he, for the most part, disappeared to, Moroni is the name of the mountain. And there's another mountain, Maela, and there's a bunch of mountains in this area that are sort of notorious in Italian history as a place. Well, now they are kind of notorious as a place for hermits, but it used to be they were notorious as a place for criminals.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to hide, if you want to get away from the cities, you might tend to go to a similar region where you know you can get kind of lost among others, but it also others know that this is the place where people go. So Peter wasn't the only such character. I mean, Peter became a very singular character only when he was elected Pope in 1294. I mean, that's an important piece of his story. That was really the only time he became a very singular character. For the rest of his life, and this is part of what makes him such an interesting choice as Pope in 1294, for the rest of his life, leading up to that point, you know, for his first 80 years, he didn't live a particularly remarkable life. He lived a relatively ordinary life. I mean, he started as a monk. He sets out on his own. He's very impacted by the writings of Peter Damian, you know, a spiritual aesthetic and theologian who convinced Peter, but also hundreds of others of men at that time, that the solitary life was the only way to really live monastic ideals, the only real way to follow Christ, because the monastery had kind of corrupted them. So he's very convinced of these things and sets out, and then he becomes a relatively successful founder of a religious order, as you mentioned, an order which becomes a branch of Benedictinism, which is a very large branch of monasticism in that time of the church, ever since the founding of communal monasticism by Saint Benedict himself. So he becomes a successful leader and organizer. He becomes the abbot of several different monasteries of sort of loose groupings of hermits all over the region. And so that desire to get away as a solitary is often sort of subsumed by Peter, because he recognizes the need to help others along the journey as well. And so he certainly is not just by himself up on the mountain all the time. He spends a lot of years of those middle years founding monasteries, funding churches, and meeting with folks in Rome, officials in Rome, and also receiving visitors for the building of a small movement. But I mean, nothing particularly remarkable, nothing on the level of the Franciscan or Dominican movements like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, so this is an important part of the story. And as we mentioned earlier, the middle part of his life becomes rather murky in terms of his details. But he is somebody who is a hermit. We get this image of him as a hermit, as a recluse, as trying to get away from, you know, the power of the church and trying to find greater purity. But also, as you mentioned, he's interacting with Rome. He's interacting with movers and shakers. Now, he might not be, you know, the top of the heap in terms of the people that he's interacting with, but he certainly has connections, and people in Rome and other places around Italy know of this guy, right?
Well, yes, because there's no way that he could successfully found a religious order, which he did, and there's no way that he could fund churches, he could secure buildings, he could do some of these administrative organizational leadership things that he very clearly did. So we don't know a lot of great details for almost 50 years of the middle of his life, but we know that he did these kinds of things to found and organize a movement. It's just that, as you mentioned, there are all these points in Peter's life where then you see him retreat again. You see him at various points sort of almost suddenly realize, okay, I've done this kind of work. Now I need to get back to my mountaintop, because it's on my mountaintop where he really seems to have felt like he knew who he was. And he was always turning back to those spiritual ideals that fired him as a young man.
All right. So how does Mr. Humble Hermit here, who interacts with the world and then retreats from it, become Pope? I mean, this is quite an amazing tale. First of all, give us an idea of how popes were selected in the 13th century.
Well, they were supposed to be selected by a conclave. A conclave literally meaning behind closed doors that are locked, you know, with a key. But in various instances, there was not a conclave. There was a sort of open election. And what that means is that the cardinals who were gathered together at the site of the last pope's death, meaning that if, you know, the pope died in Rome, then they would get together in Rome to meet, or if the pope happened to have died in Perugia or something, then they would meet in Perugia. And they were, you know, ideally supposed to stay behind closed doors like they do today, you know, and stay until they make a decision, no matter how many ballots it takes. Today, as your listeners probably know, I mean, this usually only takes couple of weeks. I don't remember exactly how many days it's been the last couple of elections, but I mean, it's never more than a month these days. It sometimes happens in 3 days and sometimes a week, or, you know, that's kind of the general gist of things. And these days, I don't know what the exact number of cardinals are in the College of Cardinals today. It changes all the time, but it tends to be somewhere between 150 and 200. And then those who are allowed to vote are of a similar number. But in these days, we were talking about, you know, 12. And they were supposed to, these 12 cardinals who were from, for the most part, from those families that we were talking about earlier, you know, the Orsini and the Colonna families, with all these powerful intentions and conniving motives often, they would get together in the room, and somehow they were supposed to come to a two-thirds majority. And it was never easy.
Yeah. So you oftentimes can get these deadlocks, and people like Peter Maroney, who take the spiritual life of the church very seriously, you can see how he would rather, it would be rather upset by this whole process. So how does he get picked? I mean, the tale of this, I just think is funny. In some respects, and almost kind of like a Monty Python type of situation. So go ahead and describe how Maroney gets picked as Pope.
Well, it all started with a letter, with a simple letter. I mean, there have been very few occasions when a letter has changed the course of history. I think that would be an interesting book to write, you know, the cases where a simple letter from one person to another ended up changing the course of history, a letter that gets leaked, you know, and revealed to others, or a letter that causes someone to do something so dramatic that, you know, it sounds like a Sherlock Holmes tale. In fact, I think there is a Sherlock Holmes tale about such a letter that Holmes has to find in order to save a war that would then break out between France and England or something. But this was one of those times when a letter changed the course of history. The cardinals who were supposed to be picking the Pope had been locked for about 2 years, more than 2 years, and Peter Maroney wanted simply to inform them of how devastating it was for Mother Church to watch as they bickered and fought rather than select the next Holy Father. It was a period known as an interregnum, or a gap, which literally means like a gap between one pope and the next, during which St. Peter's chair was sitting empty. And there were all kinds of reasons why people thought this was awful, not just because they knew the sort of power dealings that were going on, that was a big part of it, but because they needed and wanted leadership, because, again, remember, this leadership was not spiritual leadership primarily. Right. It was leadership in a world of power and influence and commerce and war. One of the big things going on, of course, at that time was a continuation of what we know as the Crusades. And the Christians had just recently really lost the Holy Land to Muslims, And there was this feeling among many still that they needed to get back there, and that until they Christians lived safely and were able to travel safely to and from the Holy Land, the world itself was not a safe place, and God was not pleased. And so we needed a pope in order to help lead the way in all of these kinds of things. So it started with a letter. The letter itself is no longer extant. I like to imagine what might have happened to it. You know, a cardinal might have accidentally thrown it into the fire with a previous round of ballots when they were trying to elect a pope, or maybe it was tucked into the pages of some book, you know, some Latin codex or something, which is sitting lost in a library somewhere in Europe. Who knows? We don't have the letter, and the only person that we know that's ever seen the letter is the one to whom it was addressed. The letter was written in June of 1294 and was addressed to Cardinal Latino Malabranca Orsini. So he was one of the Orsinis of one of those families, but this particular man was a little more sensitive than the others, I think, and he was the dean of the College of Cardinals, so he was in charge of the process that was going on. The letter was written in Latin, which means that if Peter wrote it himself, the writing would have been unskilled, because as we've already discussed, he was not particularly well educated in the language of the church. And we can imagine it might have been delivered by one of the younger monks, or one of the younger hermits, who was a follower of Peter. It certainly wasn't delivered by Peter himself. Peter was nowhere near the cardinals when the letter was read. But we get to the next thing we know. What we know is that the letter was delivered in person to Malabranca on the morning of July 5th. Again, we're talking about 1294. Mm-hmm. According to some, it was filled with holy rage. That's what one of the, you know, chroniclers says. And we don't know exactly what we said, but I'll tell you, you know, how in the Pope Who Quit, what I have sort of pieced together as what it seems to have said. It seems to have said something like this: God's judgment falls on those who ignore his will and on those who are willingly blind in seeking it. He's speaking to Cardinal Malabranca. You and the others have been like ones charged with restoring a roof to a beautiful house, and yet you leave the tools and plans at home for years on end, leaving those inside to burn in the hot sun and freeze to death during blazing summers and dread winters. The inaction you have shown will surely bring the wrath of Jesus Christ down upon you, upon your families, and upon all of us who call ourselves by his name. This was the feeling that was communicated to Malabranca, and the only thing that we know for certain that happened after he read the letter was that Malabranca quickly nominated Peter as the next ruler of God's church on earth.
I got to stop you here, because as I was reading this, we're in the middle of the Republican primary now for presidential elections. And, you know, to put this into modern day terms, this would be almost as if I whipped off an angry letter saying, you candidates are messing around too much on frivolous matters and things that aren't really important while our nation suffers. And, you know, I write this off on a napkin or something, put it in an envelope, send it out to Washington, D.C. And then all of a sudden somebody says, okay, you're the nominee.
Exactly.
So how does Moroni accept this? Because we need to also keep in mind he's 84 years old right now when he does this. And so he writes off this letter, says, you know, folks, get your act together. You need to get really serious about this process. And a couple weeks or a month or so later, you know, a bunch of horses come riding up to him at his hermitage and says, hey, guess what? We got news. You're the Pope.
Well, yes, in fact, before I exactly answer that, let me just say, so that then what happens is that Malabranca nominates Peter, and he nominates Peter using a method of electing a pope which is no longer allowed, and it's no longer allowed. John Paul II changed the rules about how you could elect a pope, and he actually mentioned specifically that one of the reasons he was changing this rule is because, you know, we don't want something to happen again like what happened with Celestine V.
Yeah.
And what happens is that he was elected by a process which, in the Latin phrase, is quasi ex inspiratione, which literally means from inspiration. And so it means that Malabranca, read this letter and then said something like, you know, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I elect Brother Peter of Moroni. Now, all of the other cardinals, it was generally known that Malabranca had some kind of a relationship with Moroni, that they knew each other and that he admired him a little bit. And so I just want to introduce another character who's really important in the story, which is that other than those Orsinis and Colonnas who were fighting in the College of Cardinals, there was another independent cardinal. I mean, independent meaning not a member of one of those families. And his name was Cardinal Gattani. And Cardinal Gattani becomes very important later in the story. I mean, I'll just go ahead and say why. Because he becomes the pope who replaces Celestine V, and he's the pope who then imprisons Celestine V after Celestine V quits. I guess it's no surprise to your listeners that he quits because that's the name of my book. But anyway, so Gattani looks at Malabranca after he nominates him, you know, and says, you know, something like, you know, you got some letter from, you know, that cardinal of yours, right? I mean, I suppose this is where this has come from. But after Malabranca proposes Peter Moroni, for a variety of reasons that we could, you know, surmise and guess, all of the other cardinals eventually agree. And most likely they agreed because, as you said, he was 84 years old. And what often happens, even today, after a papacy where it's tough to figure out, you know, what the right direction is to go, what often happens is they'll elect a very old cardinal or bishop or figure who will then lead the church for a relatively short amount of time because you know that he's not going to live very long. And so probably most of the cardinals in the room thought, okay. It's kind of a strange choice, but sure, why not? And, you know, the man's not going to live very long. And between now and then, when he dies, I have that much more time to sort of figure out how to get what I'm going to want in the next election. Mm-hmm. So then, yes, Peter Moroni is elected. And then there is that scene that you referred to earlier, which he's up on his mountaintop and he's praying. In fact, there's a great painting that hangs in the Vatican libraries that shows Peter, way off in the distance, this very lush undergrowth, this beautiful mountain with this winding path and lush undergrowth, and there's this hermit on his knees that's, you know, barely clad up in the corner, facing the other direction, devoutly praying, and then down towards the bottom of the picture, you see these noble steeds and these gorgeous flowing robes on the members of the papal curia and the messengers sent from the cardinals who are making their way up to go and find Peter and say, hey, guess what just happened?
Yeah, that's just, it has to be, you know, you described that moment very well. And, you know, we don't know what the reaction were. We don't know exactly what happens there. But again, it's very vivid in your own imagination of what goes on here. Like I say, a Monty Python thing is like, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. We're getting this ragtag old guy who just wrote off an angry letter and now becomes the most important, you know, person in Catholicism at this moment. Now take us to, you know, his acceptance. And he said, okay, I guess I'll do this. There's this calling. And, you know, when the Vatican comes calling, when the College of Cardinals comes calling, you don't really turn them down. So he accepts this, and his five-month reign is somewhat unusual. And you capture this very nicely in one of the titles of your chapters of in your book here called Awkwardness in Robes. So kind of take us through what happens with his coronation or his ascension to the throne and what happens during his reign.
Well, he tried to run away when they came to get him. I mean, the Roman poet Petrarch, who lived a century later, says that he actually tried to flee. And, you know, after a short while, they convince him that, you know, this is his destiny. This is what God wants. This is what the cardinals have chosen. And so then for probably a whole bunch of, you know, conflicting, confusing reasons, he accepts as opposed to, you know, going the other direction. So then he's crowned Pope Celestine V. And as I think I mentioned earlier, he's not crowned at Rome. They don't go to St. John Lateran, you know, where the power of the church really resided, where popes were supposed to be crowned. But they stay near his own mountain home. That's what he says that he wants in that remote province, with all of his fellow hermits in attendance. And then, interestingly, and see, a lot of these things are all intended to be, you know, little cues as to what happens later. He rides a donkey through the crowd. You know, we just finished Palm Sunday.
Right.
Peter decides he wants to humbly ride a donkey on his way to his coronation. When he gets to his coronation, he's still faced with some of those things that you mentioned earlier, like the tiara that they put on his head and the golden keys to heaven and some of these symbols that surely must have seemed strange in the hand of someone like Peter Maroney. And Peter Maroney himself must have felt pretty conflicted holding them, because this was a man who had taken vows of poverty very sincerely, as opposed to some of the sort of conniving ways in which, you know, monks and men of power would take monastic vows in those days. There's no reason to believe that Peter was anything other than quite sincere.
Yeah, the cover of your book has what I assume is the coronation or the crowning of him as Pope, or it might be another scene in there. And having read through all this, you go back to the cover of the book and just look at this, and you can see Peter is, you know, now Celestine, is looking pretty somber. He looks uncomfortable in that picture. And then you start imagining all the people who are around him just sitting there wondering, what did we just do? Who did we just pick to do this? You're supposed to love this golden tiara and the keys and the robes, and you don't look too happy by this.
Well, you know, there's that verse in Matthew 10, that verse where Jesus says to the disciples, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, be as cunning as serpents. This is not something Celestine was good at. And by the way, it's an interesting verse, because then at the very end of my book, I offer some suggestions of possible parallels between the papacy of Celestine V and the last two papacies of our memory now. So John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI. And there's a place where Pope Benedict XVI makes reference, not by chapter and verse to that verse in Matthew 10, but at his own coronation. You know, he says, I can't remember what the exact quote is, but it's at the back of my book, and it's a line where he says, you know, help me to, you know, may you pray for me so that I will be able to find my way among the wolves. And it's such an interesting idea that he uses there. But anyway, I don't want to go too far to the end of the story, and I don't want to ruin anything for the reader, but there is this very clear feeling that the people that surrounded Celestine V after his coronation, some important characters that we haven't mentioned yet, Charles II of Naples, who was the ruler of the Kingdom of Naples, and one of the important power brokers, not just of the region, but of the Western world at that time, he immediately arranged for Peter to stay, to accommodate Peter's concerns about not wanting to go to Rome. And we can guess reasons why Peter might not have wanted to go to Rome, might not have wanted to be among all of the power that was there already, and wanted to sort of go on his own, go do it a different way, kind of the way he had done his monastic life. And this suited Charles II's desires very, very well, because Charles II was a man who was completely concerned about power,
mm-hmm,
and influence. And so the idea that this new pope would stay completely within his own realm in Naples, as opposed to going to Rome, was a marvelous idea in his mind. And then take it even a step further, he takes Peter almost by the hand to Naples itself and creates rooms for him in his own home. In what's called Castle Nuovo, which was the new castle that he had just built and his father had just built on the Gulf of Naples. And so Peter is immediately then surrounded by all of Charles II's cronies. In addition to that, you know, members of the Papal Curia, of course, come, and they have to, you know, do all of the administrative work and work with Peter, you know, Celestine V, in order to accomplish that. So just imagine this simple, pretty simple hermit with spiritual ideals who is suddenly completely surrounded by these people. They eat him alive. There's a sense in Peter's story where he didn't have a chance.
Yeah. The one thing that I also found interesting, too, you mentioned he's in this Castle Nuovo. What he's surrounded by all this wealth, but he asks for people to build him a very humble wood hut, doesn't he?
He does. That's towards the end. I mean, for the first several weeks, he makes a variety of strange decisions. We don't quite know how many of them came because of Charles II trying to get done what he wanted to get done, or the papal curia trying to sometimes perhaps even trick Peter into making certain decisions. He makes some strange decisions. He creates some new cardinals. He creates a new bishop appoints a new bishop for a major monastery that seems to be a very strange choice.
Yeah.
He does a variety of things, and it's revealed later that people were sort of putting things in front of him, and he was signing them and agreeing to them, and probably didn't even quite know what he was doing.
Well, there are some things that he seemed to have made decisions on his own that perplexed a lot of people in the church. One of these things was this plenary indulgence. What was that about?
Yeah, plenary indulgence. This was probably his first mistake, and he seems to have made it because he wanted to honor the basilica in which he was crowned back in his remote part of Italy, and so he gave an indulgence to everyone who came to his coronation, and then he took it a step further and said that on the anniversary of his coronation every year, people should come and pray in this particular church, and by so doing, they would receive a special indulgence. This is the kind of stuff, of course, that 250 years later, Martin Luther would very wisely point out has got some big problems to it. And there were those in the church, certainly back then, too, in 1294, who immediately knew there were big problems with some of this stuff. And so there were some early indications that his decision-making was not quite as good as it could be. And who knows what he was thinking? I mean, he seems to have been thinking that he wanted, to give some support, including, what amounts to financial support to the hermits and the basilica that were a part of this religious order that he had devoted his life to.
Yeah. When I was reading about the plenary indulgence, one thing that I thought, and this was my interpretation of it, maybe you can correct me, was that, this decision to say, okay, if you come and visit this basilica, you get an indulgence, you get a free pass out of purgatory. And that seems to take away a lot of the power of the clergy who are entrusted with deciding whether or not you get an indulgence.
Yeah, I would agree that could very well be one of the reasons. We don't particularly know why. I mean, another reason I suggest in the book is that there was a rumor that some believe to be true at this time that Francis of Assisi had done a similar kind of indulgence for anyone who comes to the little chapel down below the village in Assisi where Francis died. It doesn't seem to be true that Francis did this, but we think that Peter/Celestine had great respect for Francis. I mean, why wouldn't he? And every Christian of that era did. And so he might have also been motivated by the idea that, what Francis did must have been a good thing to do, and so I'll do likewise.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we had mentioned before, that I talked about this wood hut that he asked to be built for him, and I'm sure people are going, what are you doing? You get to be the Pope, now you're just living in this, shanty. What's going on here?
Oh yes, sorry, I never got to that. I never got to that after you mentioned that. Yes, and so at the end of these sort of disastrous 15 weeks that he was ruling, where nothing was going well, and the papal curia was completely confused, and the cardinals were frustrated, and things were not getting done, and strange decisions were being made, and Charles II, this ruler of Italy was becoming more and more powerful, to the point where if there was going to be a new papal election, it would be held in the place where the previous pope died, which means Charles II might be in charge of the next papal election, because he would own the castle in which they would come, and he might be able to get his own person elected. And, there were all these fears and concerns going on. Increasingly, as these things happened, it seems that Peter's response, which is a very human thing to do. I mean, a lot of people would respond similarly, is to sort of shrink, right, away from conflict. Peter was not someone to sort of boldly go out into the middle of conflict and sort of resolve things. That didn't seem to be his style. His style was, just as it had been decades earlier, to go to a different mountain and go pray, to sort of get away from conflict. And so he asked that a small hut, wooden hut, be built within the palatial papal estates that had been created for him in that castle in Naples, and probably a few of the hermits from his own order who had joined him there actually built this little hut. And then the next thing he did was he asked if there could be a leader, sort of a little leadership council of three members of the College of Cardinals itself, who could basically make most of his decisions for him. So it's kind of like he wanted to recreate his little hermitage, his little mountain hermitage, wherever he happened to be. I mean, kind of like, you know, if I can't escape from where I am, maybe I can at least do this.
Yeah. And it just kind of retreats into himself in that regard. So is this what leads him to step down? Is it just gets, you know, so bad? We talked about how this occurs at the end of his reign, but it's almost at the beginning too. This is only 15 weeks. This all comes in many ways crashing down pretty quick, and a lot of people are confused, as you mentioned, and frustrated by what he's doing. What eventually prompts him to step down, and what's the process that he goes through in order to resign?
Well, within those few short months, towards the end of those short months, he began to counsel with others, particularly Cardinal Gattani, who I mentioned before, who was trained as a lawyer and who had his own selfish motivations at play. And he started to counsel to find, you know, is there a precedent by which I could step down? There wasn't really much of a precedent at all. I mean, there have been instances of a couple of other popes who quit, but not those who quit willingly. And so they had to create precedent. They had to create an argument that would make sense. And they successfully did it. So Celestine chose on his own to leave. To this day, that is the only way in which a pope can resign, is that the pope has to willingly make the decision to go. Celestine V chose on his own to leave. He abdicated before Christmas in 1294 with a brief written statement. He gave three reasons for his resignation. He mentioned his own old age. He mentioned his desire for asceticism. And he mentioned having a spiritual temperament that seemed to make him a poor pope. Very, you know, sort of honest appraisal that certainly no one would disagree with. And when he was done reading this aloud, he gathered the College of Cardinals together and forbade them to interrupt him, and read it aloud, and then he stepped down from the papal throne. He removed his ring, his tiara, his mantle. He handed them to these men who had elected him. And then just an interesting little detail that we have is that then he sat down on the floor. You know, just this image of exhaustion.
Yeah. Wow. It's one of those things you just really wish you could be there, because that's just one of those moments in history that really speak volumes about what is going on, and not only there in that room, but in the entire church at that time.
Yep. So. Yep. Well, and then a whole bunch of things happened after that, and you know, hopefully your listeners might turn to the story, you know, to discover some of this. But then Cardinal Gattani is elected pope very soon thereafter. Peter.
Yeah. What a coincidence! He was the guy helping him to resign.
Exactly. Well, speaking of Sherlock Holmes, there's then this story that emerges that Gattani might have even rigged a little system where he could speak through a tube that would then feed into the chambers where Peter was living, and he could whisper sort of angelic suggestions to Peter, because Peter was someone who was obviously a man of prayer and of mystical inclinations. And so there's this legend that came up just a few decades after this all happened, that, you know, Peter might have been, you know, sort of trying to provide the voice of God in Peter's ear, telling him that he should resign and that it was okay to do so. But anyway, so then Peter basically packs his bags and he walks back to the mountain. He wants to just walk back to the mountain, and before he can get there, Gattani, who is elected Pope Boniface, sends men to find him, basically hunt him down, captures him, imprisons him. Peter dies two years later in a prison. There's a lot of speculation in my book about how all of that happened, what the motivations were, who was involved, who wasn't. There's a reason why my subtitle says, A True Medieval Tale of Mystery, Death, and Salvation. I mean, I almost had the word murder in there, and there is the suggestion that that Peter could have been murdered. But it's a fascinating story, but it's not one that is entirely irrelevant to today. I mean, I just want to make sure before we're done that I mention, you know, I mean, I've mentioned the last two papacies and ways in which the last two popes, including the current one, there have been all kinds of suggestions that they could step down, that maybe they should step down. There have been suggestions for both of them that they were awful administrators and that they're, and that they, Pope John Paul II in particular, was sort of recreating the papacy as sort of an evangelical witness and completely ignoring all of the administrative sort of traditional, more roles of secular power that a pope could hold in ways that were compared to Celestine V. And then, of course, I mean, just in the last month, right, we've got Rowan Williams stepping down as the Archbishop of Canterbury. And, I mean, if there's anyone who, you know, had trouble being cunning as a serpent, it's got to be Rowan Williams. I mean, and, you know, a lot of the things that I've been reading, the op-ed kind of stuff about his stepping down, suggest very similar things to what I suggest about Celestine V, which is he was wise to have tendered his resignation. You know, to measure him by having been able to achieve what was completely unachievable in terms of trying to, you know, bring the factions together within the Anglican Communion. To measure him by that and say he was a failure is kind of to miss the point of the man's life. So it's interesting how Peter, the figure of Peter, Moroni, Celestine V, is one that I think has been repeated in history. That man who might have been too good for the position that he was elected to, even though that position is supposed to, you know, be Christ's vicar on earth.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful way to leave off our podcast here as we run out of time. We leave our listeners with a cliffhanger about that whole murder mystery at the end of his life and those 2 years in prison and what the motivations of Pope Boniface was all about in terms of that. So they'll have to pick up your book, which again, I mentioned is it's a great read. And so I urge people to pick up The Pope Who Quit, A True Medieval Tale of Mystery, Death, and Salvation. But also, you know, your insights on what this tale of this seemingly irrelevant figure who only lasted a few months in the papacy really speaks volumes to not only the church at that time, but the church today. So, John, I want to thank you for all your insights on this, and thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks, Tony. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope everyone enjoyed The Pope Who Quit.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.